Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Build
Film
Conversation.
Hooray!
Woohoo!
Yeah, it's that time again, guys. Podcast time, where we have a spoiler-filled film conversation. Hooray! I'm Richard Nicholas, hello. With me for the chat is Anthony Evans.
Hello.
And Abigail Bain.
Hello.
And it was me who picked the film this week. And I took us back in time. I guess every time we go back in time, we can't do a film from the future. But I took us way back, but even before World War II. World War II hadn't happened when this film came out.
Even before the world had colour. Although it did have colour, but we get into that.
Yes. I took us back to 1932, and I picked a Laurel and Hardy film called Pack Up Your Troubles. I guess I'll give the director and writer and stuff. So it was directed by George Marshall and Ray McCary. There are also some other people who might have directed, but they weren't credited. H.M. Walker wrote the dialogue, and it stars Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy and Don Dillaway, and a little girl who was played by Jackie Lynn Dufton. So that's the one you want. There shouldn't be much confusion, but there are loads of Laurel and Hardy films.
Lots.
Most of them are 20 minutes long, so I had to try and find one that was long enough to actually get a serviceable review out of. Because, you know, Laurel and Hardy fuck around with a piano for a bit. Very funny. Or bad, whatever, you know. Like, it doesn't... But this one has a bit more story to it, at least. And it's like, an hour and 4 minutes. So, still not a massively long film. But they did, like, 20-minute movies. I mean, fair enough. It's like a chore back in the 30s. To, you know, go to all that effort. You're getting a TV series worth of it, you know. Oh, it's pretty good. But they made loads, and I wanted one that was long. That was the main reason I picked this film. There wasn't like, this is my favourite or anything. I just wanted one, and this one looked interesting.
I'm kind of glad this one wasn't your favourite.
it's foreshadowing your thoughts. The only other thing I'd say as a suggestion, I thought we should go back, you know, do something properly old. Because, you know, cinema is only about 100-odd years old. And, you know, it wasn't going to make us watch a kind of film of someone, like one of the first films of like, oh, it's a train. Wow. Although that was very popular, the one where the train comes at the audience.
But that's what they say.
Yeah. But I've liked Laurel and Hardy films since I was a kid. Well, kind of more when I was a kid, because I just liked the idea of them. They're kind of two kind of iconic comedy fellows that I'd heard of. There was like a cartoon, I think, by Hanna-Barbera.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I seem to have a memory of that.
I think I remember that better than the black and white. I mean, they didn't have much access to the... I mean, they were on, like, TV a bit. But, you know, I wasn't in the cinemas in the 30s, funnily enough. But anyway, I like, knew of them from my childhood. And I even subscribed, or my mother subscribed for me, to a bunch of Laurel and Hardy VHSs. I used to get them, like, come in the post every month. And then after a while, they accumulated to such a quantity I couldn't watch them all. And they weren't that riveting. So I was like, they have too many of these to get through. And then I sort of grew up and sort of lost interest and they got boxed up. So I felt like I never really experienced a lot of true Laurel and Hardiness. So I thought, oh, let's revisit one and talk about it on the podcast. Why not? So that's why. What did you guys expect when I suggested we should do a Laurel and Hardy film?
Yeah, I wasn't overly familiar with their work per se. Like, everyone knows of them, but I can't say that I knew a great deal about them.
Well, you know, do you want to fill us in on who they are? Because you might want to, you know, describe them or...
They are slapstick comedians from the black and white era of cinema. Yeah. One is fat, one is thin. They're both clumsy. Ha ha ha.
They're not the traditional kind of funny guy, straight guy. I mean, they kind of mix it up a bit more. Like, because they're both kind of the funny guy and the straight guy. If you know what I mean.
I think
it's kind of like, when I was watching this, I kind of was, I felt like Penn and Teller, the kind of magicians, have taken a lot from these guys.
I think every kind of comedy double act has to look back to Laurel and Hardy and go, this was probably an influence.
Mm.
What you've essentially got is two idiots, one of which thinks he's cleverer than the both of them, and actually they're both kind of idiotic. And, like you know, Oliver Hardy is the chunky Southern American one with his toothbrush moustache. And he is... he thinks he's superior and blames his partner for everything, even when it's his own idea. That's kind of their gimmick. And then the skinny British one is Stan Laurel. Have I said that right?
Yeah.
I always get doubts because their names can so easily be mixed up. But yeah, Stan Laurel is usually the one people like more because he's less mean, I guess. But they're both inflicted with pain and suffering. And they're both idiots, essentially. But it is a very traditional style. Like, it kind of set the template for what double act comedy is about, really. So I think it's interesting, Anthony, you say you don't see them as a very... Like, they weren't what you were expecting, I guess.
Well, I have, some experience with them. Like, my first experience, I suppose, was the kind of adverts you get before, like, VHSs back in the day. Where it's like, the Laurel and Hardy collection, here's some montage of them falling over, but buy our videos kind of thing.
I fell for it.
Yeah, and I think I remember, like, in my teenage years, they would play, like, old silent films and, like, black and white comedies back on, like, BBC Two.
Yeah.
Like, in the morning, in the summer, when there was no school and your friends were on holiday and blah, blah, blah. So, like, and it was the 20 minute ones, and I really kind of enjoyed them. They were really fun, like, just little sitcoms of the day, even though there wasn't television.
Yeah.
I've never really seen, like, a feature length one, but I do enjoy, like, silent comedians, like Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton. I've been watching a couple of Harold Lloyd's recently. But they obviously are silent. There's a bit of overlap with the talkies, as they were called. But like, I think Laurel and Hardy were mainly around when sound. Like, I don't think they ever did any silent, because like a lot of their comedy is also based on, like, you know, jokes rather than just the physical comedy. This time around, I'm a bit weary, because generally when you take like a sitcom format, something that's like short and funny, and turn it a bit longer, it kind of gets a bit padded, and then maybe it goes on a bit long. That's generally happens these days. Like, you think of stuff like, I don't know, Keith Lemon, the movie, and Harry Hill, and like, they're fine in like 20 minute doses, but stretch it out too much and things could go wrong. Although I was, when I looked at the kind of synopsis of this one, I thought it was quite interesting because of like the storyline that was going on. I was like, oh, this might be kind of interesting to watch, how they kind of balance the comedy with the kind of depressing elements that they have. So yeah. I was kind of interested going in.
You had some inkling that it might not hold together beyond 20 minutes. Which I think is fair, because this does break down into, like, kind of 20-minute chunks in a way. Like, they very much didn't get out of the format of writing 20-minute comedy bits, because it does have... It chops up quite, you know, into different ideas that are sort of tangentially linked through a concept or through line. Abby, what was your experience of these two bowler-hatted clowns?
You mean before this?
Now I hate them, but before I was warm to them. yeah, if you want.
Well, like I said, I barely know anything about them. So, except for the odd dribs and drabs that I had seen, no strong feelings at all, really.
Oh. They never appealed to you as kind of the, like, in the origins of, like, cinema comedy and things? And
it wasn't that so much. It's just, it's not something that you stumble across very much. You have to go and look for it.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't something that really happened.
Yeah, well, a lot of the stuff is on YouTube because it's so old and, you know, is, I think, up for being put up there without any legal problems. I could be wrong. there's a big old archive of them. You don't have to, like, make any purchases necessarily.
Mm.
But there's a huge fan base. They're massive. Like, it's like a massively known global brand. I feel like, in a way, any listener is probably being patronized by me describing them as the little one and the fat one and the, you know, and, you know, but everyone knows they have bowler hats. One has a mustache that looks a bit like Hitler's, and one goes me and rubs his head. You know, people know that generally. And since, you know, most people know the general gist of it. I mean, essentially, every time they did a comedy, it was essentially two bowler hatted like people living in America would get up to something, and occasionally they would have different jobs or like do something that there was no consistent thing. It's not like they owned and operated the same business every time, or like they were kind of, they could do whatever if it meant dressing up as women. Like some stuff feels a little bit like the Chuckle Brothers, like they're playing themselves and the Scottish version of themselves and the women version of themselves. But they would do anything to serve the purpose of the skit or the sketch or whatever you want to call it. So there's, you know, but mostly they wore bowler hats and knocked each other about in amusing ways and got into trouble. And this one focuses, let's get on with this particular film. This one was focusing on them being enlisted into World War One. Like, the first half is all about them being signed up to the war. The second half is about them being the kind of kidnapping uncles of a small girl of their dead war friend. Like, so, I mean, it sounds kind of bleak, but it's like it's kind of their two uncles looking for grandparents in the second half. It's kind of an odd story, actually, overall. Like,
You're definitely right with the two halves. Like, the second half was definitely more interesting, I found. Like, that's just the jokes just seemed to land better. There was more of them. It was a more interesting situation. I don't want to say slightly like disrespectful, but I don't know. But it didn't feel right.
The first bit.
Yeah.
Well, essentially, we set up two guys on like a park bench. Oliver and Stan are both hanging out in a park, and they set up the idea that, like, they show that the newspaper's saying a war is declared, and there's a recruitment, like, military bloke there to get people to sign up. And, like, there's a bit of, you know, there is genuinely funny comedy about how, you know, Oliver Hardy is essentially saying, I joined, but I got flat feet, so I can't, and kind of making out he would like to be a hero, but actually his genuine character is of a jerk who wouldn't, a coward or whatever. And then, you know, obviously they're not, this wouldn't go anywhere if they didn't sign up out of, it is kind of horrible in a way, because they pretend to have one arm each, like they literally run away, and there's a bit of comedy about that. And then when they're confronted and asked to sign up, they're like, oh, we can't, and they pretend they have one arm because their arms are tucked away, and obviously they end up giving it
that
away.
That was the weird thing about that joke, is that they both pretended to have one arm.
It's because they'd seen a guy who genuinely, for the purposes of the film, had one arm. And they were like, they were inspired. They were like, yeah, that's it. He didn't have to join. So, yeah. And it's that kind of classic vaudeville thing of, oh, they're going to get away with it. And then they get given some money for coffee and they put up their hands, or one of them does, and like gives away. It's like, you know, silly. But it's like a classic piece of comedy, you know. Like, you kind of have to appreciate that it was the 1930s, and, you know, there was no such thing as Kevin Smith and his sort of self-reflecting, like, you know, this is like a totally new thing back then, in a way, apart from vaudeville had existed. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like, comedy is always the thing that seems to date really quickly. In like all media, like, but especially film, it always like whenever you watch old comedy, like usually it's really kind of pop culture-y and specific, so you don't get some of the references. That's like an obvious one how it dates, but like they always just seem a little controversial sometimes, just because that's just how, you know, the attitude and the taste was at the time, and obviously they change over time. So comedy is always really hard to pinpoint, because you kind of need to know the era it's from and what that was about and how people's attitudes were. So
it's weird, actually, that one piece of pop culture reference that really is, there's a lost joke in here that can't make any sense. And it's like they're looking for a Smith, and there was one joke about, like, Stan is off, like, looking for one of the Smiths, and he comes back and he says, I went to see... And then he name drops a brand called, like, the Smith Brothers, and it's like a matchbox or something. And we're like, what? Is that a... Like, it's both American and from the 30s. It's like, what, is that a famous brand of something, the Smith Brothers? He's like looking at him like, bloody idiot. The Smith Brothers brand, they're not gonna... That's not the... Like, it's all... Is it? What? Like, you're totally lost, because it's a very pop culture referencing, culture referencing joke. It's lost.
And it? I think, like, comedy just tends to kind of push the boundaries, and because everything's always heightened as well, it always seems to come off worse than maybe, like, if you watched it at the time.
So you're saying it left you cold, this stuff, did it? All this sort of dicking around the...
A lot of it, yeah. Like, I mean, there was obviously some moments where they kind of got it right. But I don't know, there was just this, like, it wasn't overly controversial or anything. Like, there was no racism or sexism or anything like that. That could have been done really easily.
Yeah.
Back in, like, the 30s. I don't know.
I think the main thing is, it's... They're as characters, they are the butt of the joke often, but they're kind of cowardly men who aren't willing to serve their country. They don't have to, but they do it in a cowardly way and in a stupid way. And then they're idiots, and it's kind of, they're kind of their comeuppance is they get enlisted out of embarrassment almost. And then I think the real jarring bit is when they go to, like, the trenches, and, you know, they set up the idea that they're going to do some, like, waking up in the trenches comedy. So it's mainly about, like, hats falling on their heads and, like, making mistake, washing with, like, coffee. And, like, there's all kinds of practical waking up in the trenches comedy to do. And then after a while, they set up a character called Eddie Smith or something. Mm-hmm. And he ends up being killed in the war. And they have to
continue.
Yeah. It was proper, like, oh, when Smith's dead, oh, Eddie's dead, okay, let's move on and do some pratfalls with the tank.
Abby?
Yeah, that's more or less what I was going to say, where it's just like, I'm not sure if that's like a cultural thing of the time or a misstep on their behalf, but it was a bit like, oh, this guy, he's got a daughter, his wife just left him, and now he's dead. Lol!
Yeah.
It didn't say that was funny, but it very much had to quickly gloss over the fact that, you know, war, people die in war.
And when they put up that title card that said, the girl was waiting for her father, who would never come home.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Oh!
maybe he got shot and injured and lost. Maybe we could, like, make it a little bit easier for the comedy watching audience. No, the realities of war were real, and therefore we must be reminded of death in this comedy film. Like, yeah, it's kind of odd.
It is odd, but, like, I suppose you have to kind of commend them for trying something a little bit different.
It's like, harsh, because the cowards live. They're cowards, and they kind of botch their way to success. So we'll talk about the scene a bit more, but essentially, they're slightly dislikable cowards. They get out of the war. And the other thing I didn't quite understand is, they wanted to chat to Eddie Smith because they want... What was the thing? They wanted to help his child find grandparents or not? Or were they... Like, I thought they might have been trying to use it as an excuse to get out of the war. Like, they had to sort of trick him into telling... Like, sort of trick him into telling...
They were trying to sort out the problem with the kid to cheer him up, I think.
All right.
Yeah, I think, it kind of... There's obviously some sort of tension between him and the family, and, like, and then if they kind of stepped in, that tension wouldn't be there, so it would be easier. I suppose, like, that's the kind of thing I got from it.
Yeah, okay, good. Because for a minute, I was like, are they using the child as an excuse to go, like, are they going to look for the kid and say, like, I don't know what they were planning. I was a bit confused. Because they were trying to keep it a secret from him, but it was to do a nice deed, and then he dies, and it's like, okay, you idiots, you have to go, and because we've had the Germans in our trenches fighting us, you have to go get some of their guys, and you have to go, into no man's land, and, and I think they end up being forced out without guns as well. They're just thrown into no man's land and have to deal with the Germans shooting at them. And then they have a bit of slapstick with a tank, which is quite ambitious, really.
It was, but it wasn't very well done. I mean, I could hardly see anything, and it wasn't the best bit of physical comedy that was in the...
Did you watch the coloured-in version? I watched the coloured-in, or did you watch the black-and-white version?
I watched the coloured version.
Okay, so it wasn't like a question if you couldn't see because it's black and white. It was
clunky. Actually, I didn't watch it in black and white, but I had both versions.
Yeah.
And I kind of like flicked through the black and white, and it did look better, if I'm being honest. Like, I don't know, it just looked right.
Yeah,
it looks
like, sort of artificial because it's coloured in rather than, you know, actually shot in colour, obviously.
Plus, it's really just odd to see them wearing, like, not grey black, because like all the iconography of them that has gone throughout the years is just them wearing all black kind of thing.
Yeah, and but they
seeing them in like yellow and blue is really odd.
Yeah, they kind of have like a sandy brown and blue suits, you know, between them, and like it is odd. Like I think the cartoon I talked about actually they had them in those colours as well. So they obviously did wear. Like, that was their look, but you can't tell because they're usually in black and white. Yeah, so it's a bit, you know, weird to watch the coloured version, I guess, but it's just a film grammar thing. It doesn't matter one way or the other, really. If you say it suited better in black and white, I understand, but I quite liked seeing it in colour, actually, seeing it coloured in. Like, it kind of, I'm surprised, actually, how good it looks, considering you kind of go, well, how did they do this? Like, they didn't colour them, literally, just in 2016 or anything, you know, it was coloured a while ago. I don't know when.
It's my impression that when they started doing that kind of thing, they did it like they did animation still.
But that frame by frame, that would be
painstaking.
That doesn't seem worth it, does it?
But that's someone's job, so.
I have definitely seen like a lot of films that have been colourised and they have just looked terrible.
Yeah, it can look really bad. I thought this one was coloured quite well, considering. It still looked odd, but it was kind of nice to see them in how they would have looked in real life, I guess. Anyway, that's just by the by. The whole thing with the tank, they got quite a stunty bit. It's a bit more akin to a Charlie Chaplin or Harold Lloyd bit, where it's much more of a physical stunt they have to do with like a tank that's in no man's land. They hide in it, and then Oliver can't get in because he's fat and clumsy, and then inside Stan is like knocking the levers, and they're precariously driving through no man's land, and it's kind of farcical and silly, but it is what it is. It's just stupid and fun.
It was just a bit because it was in the dark and they were surrounded by clouds. You couldn't take much of it in.
Yeah, his little butt's up in the air, his feet are wriggling, and then they end up emptying the trench out of Germans, because, you know, they drive through it in the tank, and get somehow, through the magic of bad editing, get them all entangled in barbed wire and dragged to the British trench, and somehow end up being kind of heroes, in a sense. And then that kind of ends the whole chapter of the war. We set up this guy, Eddie, with a child, and his wife, his girlfriend or wife or whatever has left him.
That's another cheery bit. The letter that he got from his wife, I never loved you.
Yep.
Now I found someone to care for. Don't love me.
Eddie's a real tragedy lost in these two lovable schmucks who are just goofing through life. It's good that they're nice. They are trying to be nice and they look after his kid. They do kidnap his kid from the adopted, albeit horrible adopted parents, but they stay villains for a while. They're bad in the army. I forgot, they did a whole training thing where they can't march properly there's not any point really describing it because it's just, so Stan and Ollie behave like complete tools and bumble and fuck up everything that they possibly can, and like, you know, Oliver blames Stan for everything, and they get court-martialed. Oh, actually, there was quite a good bit with Garbage and the General or whatever. What did you think of that shit? No.
I liked the guy's moustache.
He's a regular, I think, for the sketches. He's one of the main, like, foils, I guess, for Stan and Oliver. Like, he will take whatever, like, evil Baron or whatever figure they need who has a moustache and is an older man. Yeah. He will be
I felt that with a lot of the actors. They all had a certain look where it's like, you are very archetypal bad guy. Mm. You are very archetypal, mean guy. I can imagine them being used like just a kind of like a revolving doorway where they keep using the same actors kind of thing.
Yeah, and how like typecasting worked back in the day and was sort of fine back
well,
then.
It's not...
You had a little niche as that guy.
It's not necessarily typecasting. I think they could have been part of like the sketch, like people. They were their guys, you know. They were
little repertory company kind of deal.
They were part of the Stan and Oliver crew, you know. They were they were as much of the comedy as Stan and Oliver. But like essentially, Laurel and Hardy would always play Stan, Laurel, and Oliver Hardy in everything. Their jobs would change. What they wanted to do would change. The cast who are often there, like there's a guy in the wedding scene, he's in them a lot as well. There's probably others within the wedding that make reappearances in other films by these guys. So it wasn't just their typecast. It was literally they were the guys who always did it.
Yeah, fair enough. I get what Abby's trying to say though. It's like one certain guy would always play the kind of rich guy. Another guy would always play the kind of thug guy kind of thing.
Yeah, you've got broad characters, definitely. But I kind of liked they were sort of trying to learn how to march and they were doing it badly, and then they were forced to do like the slopping in the kitchen and stuff, and the whole thing was just they were told to put a lot of garbage cans, which were full of just lettuce. They treated it like it was horrible, foul, like rotten rubbish, but it was all just lettuce leaves, to me, as far as I could tell.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just told to chuck them in the general, and I presume the chef meant general waste. But they took it to the actual general, who was having a boiled egg and was worrying about the smell. And for some reason, they had that crap character of the butler who couldn't smell because he had a cold. That was lame. I don't know why they had him. And then, you know, they just fall over and get filth everywhere and, you know, prove themselves to be feckless idiots. Which, that's their thing, though. They do everything they do badly, and it's sort of funny. And I thought their falling was quite good in the early stuff. I genuinely did like the comedy, and I think the main thing comes down to, yes, it's kind of old and a little bit dated, and sometimes it's a bit broad, but actually, they're quite charming characters, the two of them, you know?
Yeah, no, definitely. But I just felt like it was just... Like, the first half was just kind of standard. I can kind of predict. It's like, obviously, they're going to march wrong, and then they're going to get in trouble, and then they're going to fuck something else up kind of thing.
But I think there's an artistry to it. They obviously did it so many times. I think it's so... Like, the way they set it up, and it's just... You kind of like the arrogance of Oliver Hardy. Every time, he's like, just listen and do what I say. And then he inevitably sets up the fall and the mistake, and then he instantly blames his partner. And like it's like the perfect format to keep repeating because it's kind of so satisfying a gag to use. And it's just that's kind of the shtick they do all the time is just like this, just two idiots who fuck everything up, and then one blames the other, and the other one gets his own back by being luckier. I guess, or subtly smarter, occasionally. I don't know. I just wanted to come to their defense a bit because I don't want to just brush it off as like, you know, boring. Old
I'm not saying that. Like, I just found myself laughing more in the second half.
Sure. Once we'd got past the death of a man who we'd just met and has a sympathetic after the harrowing tale of Eddie Smith, the unloved, unwanted father who is dead because of the Germans, and now stupid Uncle Stan and Uncle Oliver are going to try and look after his kid for a bit. Is basically, it's a bit easier because it's like kind of endearing. The kid's a very good actor, actually. I thought she was very sweet and.
You could see she was. There's a scene we'll get to later on when you see she's trying really hard.
They asked a lot in that scene. Like, are you talking about the scene where she like tells the whole story of like Goldilocks and the three bears?
Yeah,
and you could see she's struggling because it's like you can't just ask a small child in one take to do all of the Goldilocks story.
Exactly, but she does. She knows she's trying really hard, and she does get there. Like, and she's just like a really cute and sweet, and it's very endearing.
Which is good because the actual joke was lame.
Yeah,
like Stan is falling asleep because. The story is a sort of bedtime story, and it's taking a long time to tell the story. And we're all sitting there going, we've actually reached the low point of your film where we're a bit bored, and you're choosing to have someone fall asleep in front of us, and the only entertainment is a little girl is saying a story everyone's heard, and it's just, let's all just fall asleep, should we, guys?
Yeah. So yeah, that was a bit like a bit of a moment. Like, I did find the thing, even though it was only an hour, just a little bit padded out, because that was one of the kind of unnecessary scenes.
Did you feel the same, Abby? I got a feeling like you didn't particularly weren't particularly in love with it.
It's not their fault. My relationship with slapstick is poor because I am a klutz. So it's not funny to me. I just look at it and go, that's just a normal day.
I think they're a little cleverer and sweeter than stuff like, say, Bottom, which is just purely about kind of Tom and Jerry violence. Mm. And kind of grotesque humour, like the kind of more modern stuff. Like the kind of grotesque slapstick is kind of, when it's well-timed, funny, like it's clever slapstick, I think it works better.
Like, oh, yeah, you know, like I think definitely that's their kind of physical comedy slapstick was the strong point of the whole thing. Well, it is, it's just the physical comedy is always just more endearing because I suppose everyone can really relate to falling down and everyone laughing at you kind of thing.
Mm. Yeah.
And the same, you know, you see someone kind of do something silly and you laugh at them. So it's always the more kind of endearing part.
Yeah, because this stuff that's just purely, oh, well, you know, Oliver walks into a wall, like, and he makes the same noise he makes every time, which is fantastic. But he bumps his face. I don't find that as good as moments where you kind of, you appreciate the setup. Like, there's a few times, like, you don't expect it, or, like, there's one where Stan stands up, and because Oliver's still on a bench, it tips and it smacks the chef in the face, who's in jail with them because, you know, they got in trouble. That kind of stuff I liked better. And, like, the stuff, there was quite a good one where they're outside, like, a property, and they break, Oliver breaks the doorknob off, then passes it to Stan to give him the blame. Then Stan discards it to the floor and it hits Oliver on the foot. He gets annoyed, and then he, like, hits Stan. Stan then drops a book on his foot, and it's just, like, it's satisfying, because he's just, you morons. And it, like, like the choreographed nature, when it's just, for every time Oliver tries to hurt Stan, Stan gets lucky, and almost threefold gets Oliver hurt, which is kind of a nice, it's kind of a satisfying format, because he's the slightly dislikable one of the two. I find those moments are when they're at their strongest, where they've choreographed a really well-timed, like, let's, you do this, I'll do that, and then we'll awkwardly do a bit of knocking about, and it'll be funny, you know?
I agree. They both kind of have their roles to a T by the, kind of like this point. Like, the writing is probably not as strong in this one as it has been, but, you know, they're still Oliver and Hardy. They know what they're doing.
Yeah, like, and the dialogue between them is always funny. It doesn't, some of the stuff where they're talking to characters that have just come into scenes to do a bit of, like, stupid stuff. Like, I like the two of them together more than anything. And I think that's probably why the 20-minute ones, some of the more famous ones they've done, where it's just 20 minutes of, we got this set up and we're going to play around, knock a piano around, or we're going to be in a ballroom and get into trouble with this or that. You know, they work really well. Because you've got some props, a concept, and they can play their characters for a bit. Whereas this one, you're like, why are they kidnapping a child now? You know?
Mm. Although, to be fair, like the first scene they have of, like, the child in her, like, new kind of adoptive home was really horrible.
It was.
It was, like, so horrible. Like, the idea of them being kidnapped by Oliver and Hardy is acceptable. Not just acceptable, but, like, the right thing to do. Oh, God, it was so bad. Like, she goes and gets, like, finds a picture of her dad, and she's like, is this my daddy? And, like, everyone being really horrible to her, and then, like, the husband beating up the wife, or implied beating up the wife off, and then just about to, like, beat her up before Oliver and Hardy turn up. It's like, Jesus Christ.
I mean, it was the 30s, there was a depression. These people are keeping a child for the money. Why? They just want to sleep and get by, and they have this annoying child being innocent and sweet in their face. I can totally sympathise with them. Why wouldn't you want to tell her to piss off?
Oh. So, but then, like I said, it may have been necessary to do that, to make them kind of semi-kidnapping her all right.
It's like on the moral high ground. They were friends with her dad, and they're doing it to find the grandparents. But essentially, they do it without any sort of, you know, they don't file any paperwork or make any inquiries. Yeah. They don't. They just literally turn up at the house and are like, "We're taking the kid." What do you mean you're taking the kid? Well, we don't even know that you're horrible, but we're taking the kid to find the grandparents. And then they basically get in a fight and throw boiling water at the adopted father and his stooges who are fighting on his behalf as well.
At the end of that fight, he throws the two pots in after them.
Yeah.
But as soon as he did that, I was like, you might actually hurt them doing that.
Scolded those bastards and possibly injured them with bullets. It was such a, like, these two slightly cowardly men, you're like, they're not going to win this fight. And the way they do it is like, oh, they throw boiling water at them. It's kind of messed up. So anyway, they abscond with their child, but we're happy, as Anthony has said, because the original guardians were horrible, and Stan and, you know, Oliver are actually all right. And, you know, it's a better option. And the kid likes them, and for once, they're actually being selfless and trying to look after her, and, like, doing chores in the house instead of trying to get out of things, which is usually their MO, is to, let's get out of things, like, as much as possible. But, like, yeah, so the main concept that works, really, is them looking after the child and trying to find... It's more interesting, the idea of trying to find these parents, and they kind of go through the phone book, and, like, there's lots of different people they come across, and it's all just an excuse for them to make mistakes and get punched or ruin a wedding. And what else do they have happen?
They confuse a policeman.
Yeah.
That's a bit of a nothing scene.
Yeah.
They kind of prove the child was like them, because after a while the policeman gets sick of listening to these two dopes and then asks the child, like, and as soon as the child, like,
says... That's basically the same thing.
Yeah, it's like, oh, who are you looking for? Oh, like, Mr. Smith. All right, and where's he? Where's who? Oh, it's like, you are one of them! I kind of like that idea. You know, it was a bit of a nothing scene in a sense, but it is about these two idiots being tup and just... Yeah.
There was, like, they come up to a boxer, and they think that he's trying to blackmail them. They're trying to blackmail him, and so he just punches them.
He has gloves, like, in a Popeye cartoon, that guy. It's odd seeing it in real life, just really round, cartoony-looking boxing gloves.
The wedding thing went
on a bit longer and had a lot more characters. That they just set up this moron who's getting married. Like, this bloke's some kind of dimwit, and he's getting married, and it's in this fancy house. And there's a confusion as to, like, the people who used to live there were called Smith, and then, you know, Stan and Oliver turn up and assume that they've found the person, and they basically present the child, and because it's the 30s, if someone has already had a secret child, it's a complete scandal, and they've saved a woman from marrying a cad. And it was just a bit, wait, we don't even know these people, what's going on? What did you guys make of the scandal at the wedding and the whole thing, really? I mean,
it was fine, but it just felt a bit like, oh, I already kind of know how this is going to play out from the beginning. So, but it was fine.
It did lean on that classic cinema trope of people not asking enough questions.
Yeah,
I was just going to say, if any one of them asked a question, it would have been sorted out. But no.
Comedy for you.
Yeah. I don't know, it was just all a bit obvious. Although there was, like, one bit that made me really laugh was when, like, the wife, like, is like, how can I ever repay you for saving me from this cad? And then just, like, gives this huge snog to
Stan,
yeah. And then he just doesn't know what to do, and then he goes off to go off screen, but, like, he's held back. I like that moment.
I was wondering what Oliver Hardy was thinking. Just like, oh, well, I also brought the child. But yeah, it was... I think the stuff that worked for me was more when they were back... They kind of, you know, reached a dead end with knocking on doors. And they were, like, basically decided, yeah, we're fawning from now on. We're not going to get practically involved. And then they're back at the house with a kid and... They're kind of infighting amongst themselves as they usually do, and there's a bit of weird. I'm going to crack you over the head with a baseball bat, And, like, I quite like the scenes.
And there was a lot of kicking or spanking of bums in this.
Laurel and Hardy love a good kick up the arse.
Yeah.
They would probably do the funniest kicks up the arses of anyone as well. Because there's something about how they react as well. And it's like each of them get kicked up the arse differently. It's particularly satisfying when Oliver gets kicked because he's got such a plump behind. And the noise it makes is just, doh! It's just kind of like, just not quite a doe, but like, doh! Like, it's hard to do. It's just very satisfying.
Could you explain something to me?
Go on.
And then in the bank, he sticks a chair. And I don't understand why.
Because that's another weird thing about the film. They've out of nowhere, are suddenly in charge of what's it called? A restaurant on wheels,
a food truck.
A food truck, like a food restaurant truck thing. And they, like, apropos, I guess they did technically work in the kitchens in the army, so there's some continuity. But they own like a food truck for no reason other than they wanted to do a scene in a food truck for a bit.
Although I think my favourite joke was just when all the cats just all just flee out of there. I love that. Just they all like are driven out of there with such ferocity. There was clearly must have been someone in there like pushing them out or something.
Yeah,
I love that. It was like moments like that were my favorite. I think there was another one where, like, I think it's back at the house and like the guy faints and then someone gives him like some smelling salts and then all of a sudden it's just been passed to Stan. And he doesn't know what to do with it, and he sniffs in, and his, like, hat flies off. But just stuff like that.
The stuff that's a bit more unexpected and surreal.
Yeah. Those are like, my favourite moments.
Kind of catch you off guard. Yeah, there's kind of... They are living cartoons. That's the thing with them. That's why they turn to a cartoon, I guess, as well, is in later on. Was just, they are... it's what can cartoons do? Let's try and mock that up. Actually, I mean, the reason we were talking about this was to get to the point where, essentially, I think... Oliver's in the back of the food truck and he's crashed and all the stuff falls on him and he's like tore his pants or something. And so I think his pants have caught on the seat in the bank. That was the answer, Abby, to that.
Oh, also he got shot up the arse.
Well, that's right, he didn't he? And apparently getting shot, it must have been buckshot because it just tore his pants up.
Yeah, so maybe it was related to that. It wasn't particularly clear.
Fat man tears his pants. It's funny. But yeah, like they play fast and loose with injuries just because it'd be even more harrowing if they actually just like the very fact that he can come in and hit his friend with a baseball bat on the head and then be like he doesn't go for it initially, but they are constantly conking themselves. They should have a proper hospital bill and possibly trauma to the head. Maybe that's why they're so stupid, is all the sort of strikes to the head they suffer. Actually have brain damage. But I did like the stuff in the house where it was just getting frustrated. Like the whole throwing down the baseball bat, it bouncing off a drum, hitting him, bumping his head. Then the weirdest one was, I think, Oliver stands on a baseball then thrown by Stan and hit him already.
Is that a baseball?
Was that what it... Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
What did you think it was?
I thought it might be a whole head of garlic.
Oh,
okay.
I think it was a toy ball anyway.
Okay.
But they did that. He did that pratfall, but it was like a faked one. Like they do a lot of their own stunts, but they had a weird. It was almost like a stop animation of a ridiculous cartoon fall where, like, I don't know if they must have took pictures of like chucked a dummy, like a big fat dummy, and throw it doing a flip and then landing and then knocking over like whatever, like bucket of water or something. Do you remember that bit? It was just really odd, bad visual. Do you guys remember?
Yeah, it was mental. You're right.
How did they do that? It was just like a terrible stop animation with a dummy or what? Like, it was really odd.
I wondered maybe if they'd put him on wires.
No.
He had done a slow spin and then they sped it up because it was so incredibly fast that it went around.
Like, you couldn't quite tell what happened. I don't think it was like a wire work. But, I mean, it certainly wasn't CGI. Like, they must have just done a bit of camera trickery, but it looked really dopey. But I like a big, violent, ridiculous fall. They're quite good at them, too. Anyway, like, but, yeah, it kind of culminates in them... What, they need money because they're getting into more and more trouble with the law. And what do they need the money for? They need it to travel out of state because they're worried because they're getting loads of trouble, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Why they needed like lots of money to do that, I'm not quite sure. But, well, you know, here's another scene.
They have a business, but they don't have enough money to leave for some reason. They have like a truck. They could drive across the state. Maybe they need petrol money. But they try and get out a loan, and they just have a scene in a bank where they hand out sausages mistakenly for cigars, which is a bit kind of a crap joke, but I think they milk the most of the cigar sausage mix up as they can. And it's just like, I quite like the ending of that scene where you're not getting a loan if this is your crappy business. I'd have to be like unconscious, and then he obviously knocks himself out, and they're like, well, that's as good as a yes from a bank manager. Him saying, you'll only get the money if I'm knocked out. He happened to knock himself out. That's basically take all the money you want, right, guys? They have that kind of logic, and I admire them for that. But, you know, they get into more and more trouble. And it kind of escalates to the point where there's, like, a mob after them of cops and, like, officials. And they're hiding out. They do some really funny, terrible hiding as well, like in the cot. Or my favourite one is when Stan's trying to hide in a bucket with the child, just crouched down. And there's a moment where the guy looking for them doesn't react to it at first, as if he's successfully hiding. So I kind of like that. But there's a whole like scene where they're kind of just trying to hide and get away with it, and using the dumb waiter to get rid of hide the kid, and they end up, you know, falling down the dumb waiter, and you know all the stuff you'd expect to happen unfolds, and you know, there's not much point describing. So then like Stan hits Laurel, and Laurel hits the floor, and you know, blah blah blah, and you know,
pretty much.
But there is some poetic callbacks to be done at the very end. Like, are they essentially getting in enough trouble that they... well, how do they end up in the correct people's house?
Is they wrong bank?
Yeah, and that the bank manager turns out to be the person that they're looking for, the grandfather of the child.
Ah, yeah, so they're taken there, like, handcuffed for some reason, and then it's like, wait, your name's Smith, and this is Eddie Smith's child, your grandchild. Hooray, at the last minute of the film, we've reunited the girl with her grandparents, and apparently that's enough for the bank manager to drop charges and let them to be unhandcuffed, even though I'm pretty sure they're still criminals.
Yep.
But and then all the extra bit of they have a call back to the chef they were in the army with, who hates them and said that he was going to kill them if he had a knife ever again, or something. And he's the chef who's very angry, and in the employ of the bank manager. And so they get chased away by a chef with a knife, because you know no one gets to sit down happily and have dinner and live happily ever after in Laurel and Hardy land. They were eternally tortured by life because they're thick cowards. So, you know, that was the slightly odd plot of pack up your troubles. Because you've got to pack up your troubles and join the army. Is that what it was called? Or they say it at the end. What the hell is it called, pack up your troubles?
I don't know. The only thing I could think of was that they wanted to use the tune for the song, pack up your troubles in your old kid bag. Which they did. They did the whole classic of... Here's a melody, now let's play it in several different ways for different scenes. Did you notice that?
Well, they have the kind of the Laurel and Hardy theme is played a lot for the throughout the film as well. Like, they have kind of a go-to bit of music that is them. Not just the theme tune to their... Like every cinema reel would start with their theme. But then they have the kind of music that is in all of their films as well. But yeah, it's kind of a nice motif. It's kind of like just an old-fashioned thing to do.
Yeah, makes sense. And I was like, that's the only kind of reason I can think of.
I guess it's sort of...
They were kind of shipped off, kind of pack up your troubles.
Their troubles, the trouble they are always in is being packed up and sent, you know, to fight in the fields of World War One.
Yeah, and so like, maybe that was like the original title when, like, I'm just assuming things now, but like maybe it was intended as a kind of a short, just the first kind of army bit.
Yeah, and also a kind of ironic, like, turn of phrase, I guess. I'm not worrying about it too much. I just was kind of thought we'd shed some thoughts on it. But, you know, I think its main thing is it's all a bit too disconnected. Like,
yeah,
the army stuff you don't have to have the child thing thrown in there. You can just have, like, two comedy characters. Like, they did some good stuff. It felt a bit like Blackadder Goes Forth at some points, you know?
Hmm.
And it was, like, a good idea, you know, a good setting, in a sense, to make people... You know, a lot of people had recently dealt with friends and relatives dying in the war and being affected by it. So you need a bit of comedy about it after World War One. So by the 30s, you're kind of hoping, you know, let's make fun of it and move on.
Like, hopefully enough time would have passed for you to be able to kind of joke about it. Maybe that's why I felt a bit weird, because the people still alive after World War One would still be around, and it's just kind of, how would they be feeling watching this kind of... Yeah. The people who have actually been in the trenches and were the people training... training all the people, you know, those guys. Mm. How would they feel about made to look the fool kind of thing?
But they would have presumably had people in the trenches with them that were idiots that they could have laughed at as well. Like, you know, it's not permanent sadness. You know, as harrowing as, you know, World War One and World War Two were portrayed, there are downtimes in wars, and it is horrible and sad, and people are dying. But even in the trenches, you can't be sad all the time. So that, like, people did other things to try and keep the morale up and be happy, and like, it wasn't like the trenches of World War One were constantly sad. You know, some of it was boredom, it was death, it was kind of this messed up situation. But it's not like constant tragedy, so I think that audience could cope. And also, the other main thing is, it's just weird because they have that guy die. It just doesn't fit with the comedy of the film.
Just a very jarring thing to link them all together.
Yeah, because you know, like Charlie Chaplin did war-related films. Like, I mean, The Great Dictator is supposed to be a really great piece of cinema. I'm all right with it, but again, it's just a kind of concept piece about war, and you know, it's just how many bits of comedy can we do about different aspects of that concept. And it's a fine idea for a film, but it could have been split up into a couple of 20-minute chunks, couldn't it? And
yeah, I think it might have been a bit stronger that way.
Hmm. But like, I mainly wanted to show, like, I wanted to show you guys what Laurel Hardy is about, because I've seen quite a few, but they're kind of spaced out. And I mean, I do get bored watching Laurel and Hardy from time to time. But the two of them as a double act are kind of amazing. Like, and they're early on, they're to be appreciated, even if they don't stand the test of time sometimes.
Yeah. Plus, it might just, like, these days, I mean, they haven't been really popular now for, you know, 70, 80 years practically. It's really hard. It's really easy to underappreciate, like, their mark on cinema. Mm. Like pretty much any kind of, like you say, any kind of like double act after them, there will always be compared to kind of the Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah, and for me, their shtick is kind of timeless comedy, and I wanted to just test that theory, because I think they're funny now, no matter what. There's something funny about what they do. It's kind of family. It's kind of for children. I think children particularly are susceptible to them, because they're kind of brought... They're like a cartoon. Like, maybe as adults we can't appreciate it. But actually, as like a 10 to 14-year-old perhaps, or maybe a bit younger, you should find them funny. You might be a bit weird, because like, for now, kids will be like, what the hell is this old fucking period drama, like grey shit? But it's still two guys being funny, and you understand them as a child because they're so kind of over the top and caricatured as people, you know.
Yeah.
And how do you adults take them, though? That's the thing. Was it timeless comedy, or was it kind of grating and you wish you hadn't watched it, or what?
No, a lot of it was like did endure a lot. Like I said, like a lot of the physical comedy. Because that is just kind of universal, isn't it? And everyone of all ages, of all cultures, could just understand pain.
Pain is funny.
Yeah.
Falling down is hilarious.
Pain to other people is always funny. Or, like, as just, it, yeah.
And people being kicked up the arse.
And then the dynamic is also endured.
Idiots are funny. Falling is funny. They're never not going to be.
Yeah, and they were dealing with some interesting kind of things. Like, it's hard to see them as controversial these days because of some of the comedy that we've seen in, like, the 80s and 90s, especially.
Sure.
But, you know, so some things didn't sit right with me because just comedy always kind of tends to push boundaries. And they did that, and it's not so hard to see from our perspective now.
Well, actually, one thing, because it was the 30s, I was pleased that the one black actor in it was a black person, because that's, even later on, it's like, well, we don't get black people to be in cinema. They called on, like, one of the Smiths they're after, and he's black, and then Stan's still like, are you the father of this white child? And all of us, like, you are a dickhead. I was glad. It's like, you did actually get a black guy in for that, because it could have been very uncomfortable otherwise.
Mm.
They don't usually do anything offensive, even by today's standards. Even, like, if you consider, it's the 30s, it was a different time. They don't, like, portray races badly very often. Like, I can't think of many examples where Laurel and Hardy do stuff that would be acceptable then, but isn't now, you know? I don't think so, anyway.
Yeah. Well, what I'm trying is, I think maybe controversial isn't the right word, but they're trying new things. They're trying to add something, like, they try and add the tragedy in there. Which, you know, it's been done. I mean, Charlie Chaplin became the kind of master of balancing tragedy and comedy. But
they're cutting edge, you know, for the 30s. That's the thing.
Mm,
yeah. They're the contemporary biggest names in comedy in the 30s. There is no more famous filmmakers than these two guys at that point. So they're very much not to be judged like old hat, you know, stuff. Abby, what did you... Overall, and maybe you can think of a rating for us to go with, a metaphor.
But I have a metaphor.
Yeah. What are your final thoughts? How did you receive these guys?
They are a cup of tea. Where, right. Like, a lot of people find great satisfaction in a cup of tea. It doesn't really matter what kind of tea.
Mm.
It's just tea, and that makes people happy. But I don't like tea.
And tea can be thrown over you, scold you, and be used as a violent prop for... fighting off attackers.
So they are in many ways not my cup of tea.
It's just too traditional a beverage for you, Abby. You're a modern, probably a smoothie drinker or something, aren't you? Probably into all the cool, freaky coffees with maple syrup in and stuff, are you?
No, I go super old-fashioned and drink water.
Oh, I like things bland. Well, I don't know how that works into your metaphor.
No, they are tea.
So, but what is water then in your... it doesn't matter. You weren't trying to say water is like anything. The point is, they're just not your cup of tea, but you appreciate them. It's a thing that a lot of people like and can get pleasure out of.
Yeah.
What's the main reason you don't quite click with it then?
You're talking about tea or Laurel and Hardy?
Laurel and Hardy, because I would argue they're timeless, like a cup of tea in a sense.
Well, I said, didn't I? Like... Slapstick's not funny to me because I'm a klutz.
You just feel bad when you watch people hurt themselves.
It's not even so much as feel bad as, like, yeah.
You just get... it's too much of a reflection of your own pathetic, Laurel and Hardy life. Oh. But, yeah, you did say that, but I was just wanted to make, you know, absolutely sure I understood.
Like, when they get extreme, then it tends to entertain me a little bit more.
Okay, so you've not actually fallen down a dumb waiter, and you don't sympathise with that because it's ridiculous.
Yeah. So at the extreme edges, it entertains me, but when it's more sort of subtle and...
Just hurting yourself, getting kicked in the shin, or walking into a wall.
Yeah, that doesn't entertain me, because it's just like, oh, I've done that recently.
Okay. Okay. Anthony, do you have a metaphor?
I don't know. Maybe if I sum it up, one will come. Like, my problems with it were more in the format than anything else. If they were just slightly tighter, three slightly tighter stories, maybe even two, that, you know, just kind of concluded and had their own little thing, I think it would have been better. Because that's just what I'm used to. And this type of comedy just... after a certain point, it's a bit much.
You'd rather watch little sketches that they did rather than a big, elongated film.
That's what I'm used to with them.
20 minutes before the proper movie comes on.
Yeah. But saying that, you know, I can totally appreciate it. Some of the writing was off, but they are just doing what they do, and they are obviously really good at it. So just watching it for them alone is enough. Like it doesn't make me not want to watch any more Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah.
But I think it's probably one of the weaker things that I've seen of them.
Yeah, there's worse. Some of their stuff in the 40s, because they're getting older, and I don't know if it's because of this old hat or it's just a bit too dated by like the late 40s, but some of that stuff's a little bit, oh dear. Like, yeah. Especially when they start to look old and not like themselves, it's like, oh, that's you're too heavy now, Oliver, to be doing some of this stuff. It's a bit, you're actually going to die and I'm concerned. But,
yeah, I think maybe if I stick with a kind of team metaphor here, it's kind of like I like tea, but maybe this time like it's the tea was too strong and it was served in too big a cup, so it's gone cold by the time I finished it, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's someone who's ploughing loads of tea on you, and you were satisfied at the first cup, but now they've refilled and it's not warm anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's you being polite and you like tea, but you still can't drink that much.
Yes. Okay. But you know, I'll definitely be back and drinking tea the next day, kind
yeah,
of thing.
You
just want a teacup, not a sports drink mug.
Yeah.
Just
you need a tea break, that's all. You need a break in the tea. And they'd be back drinking it again. Right, okay. I can't think of a way to link it to tea, but I think Laurel and Hardy are like a box of chocolates. Mm-hmm. And not because you don't know what you're going to get, because I don't know about this Forrest Gump, but all the chocolates I've bought that come in a box come with a little handy slip that tell you exactly what each of the chocolates are. So that metaphor defense, doesn't work in Forrest Gump. He's a retard.
No, but he's also, like, he grew up in, like, the 60s, so that might not have been a thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you go back far enough, you have to go to the chocolatier and order your chocolate and select particularly which ones you wanted. Anyway, so maybe Forrest Gump isn't all that stupid, but I think Laurel and Hardy are like a box of chocolates, and this is why. Chocolates are great. Classic thing to eat. It's the perfect form of sugar. It's satisfying, tasty. Cocoa beans are brilliant, and they were perfectly turned into chocolate. Classic. Chocolate is just, you could do anything with it. They're like, you know, really good chocolate. But, like a kind of tray or box of chocolates, there's always going to be some that you don't want. Like, for me, it's like nuts. I don't like the nut ones. And times in the film, there's stuff was like, oh, that isn't as good, or this is a bit boring, or there's certain clunky bits that weren't for me. But overall, it's great because you've got a box of chocolates and it's so nice. But almost in a way, the length thing, it's too much. It's like eating all the chocolates in a box. And they're great, but it's too much and you feel sick afterwards. So maybe you need to have a bit of restraint and just watch 20 minutes / have a few chocolates, pick the good ones and enjoy them and appreciate it and kind of ration it out a bit. And that's kind of why it's like chocolates, because you can overdo it. There are some horrible ones. And, you know, but at key, Oliver and Stan are chocolate. They're brilliant. People have come along with chocolate and turned it into all kinds of amazing things. But if you go back to it, it's still just the product itself is great. It's just, you know, whether you have it to excess or whether you have it in variations you don't like. So there we go.
Okay.
It's tea and chocolates.
For me, it's the Turkish delights.
You don't like them?
No.
No.
You can throw them away.
It's disgusting.
It's a bit much, isn't it?
Sorry, Turks.
I don't get it. Like flowery jelly stuff. What's up with that?
What's up with that? Yeah, I don't know.
So there we go. Indeed.
They're not a delight, and they're not Turkish. Anyway, you know.
While we're on the subject, I don't like the ones that have coffee in them.
Oh well, yeah. I get you. Fair enough. Tea, coffee. Technically, a closer link. Now that you've mentioned it. Well, you know, if you want to contact us, figure it out, listener. You can tell us what box of chocolates you prefer and which ones you don't like and how that relates to Laurel and Hardy, and we'll be happy to hear from you. Or you could just, you know, find us on iTunes, do all the usual stuff, look at our other podcasts. We've done loads. So that's just for the listener, a bit of prompting. You know, you don't have to just sit there dribbling. You can click more buttons and play more things and contact us. Anyway, We should say goodbye, right, guys?
Yes. Goodbye, right, guys?
Bye.
Toodlepip. Wave your tie in that Oliver Hardy way.
I have a tie, but I can wave my dressing gown for
it. You wave your dressing gown, then. Happy! That's scandalous. Bye.
Bye.